Welcome,
guys,
to another episode of Eigen Bros. Today, we were talking about sort of a primer into string theory.
Mm-hmm. So we give some good information. It's a slightly shorter podcast, mm-hmm. I guess I went on a factual tirade.
No, it's good because it lays out a survey. It's mm-hmm. a survey of string theory, just briefly kind of going over some stuff. We talk about renormalization, what it means to to have a gauge theory, quote mm-hmm. unquote, all these big terms, manifold stuff. You know, you see all this stuff. The different types of string theories mm-hmm. we kind of briefly discussed, and I'm kind of surprised we ended up talking almost 50 minutes about this because as physicists, this is a science. How would you say? A popular sci-pop?
Yeah, it's a really popular thing within within popular science. Mm-hmm. But it's so out of our wheelhouse too, also. So
this isn't taught in
normal
coursework.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if you're not a string theorist or like if you're not even a quantum field theorist, like you're not going to really know much about string theory. Like
right.
me and Juan are condensed matter physicists, so mm-hmm. this is way out of our wheelhouse.
Right.
Completely out of the scope of what we normally do.
Yeah. But this is still nonetheless something that's interesting. If you're a physicist, fundamentally, you're still interested in this kind of stuff.
Exactly.
So
hopefully we did it justice.
But look out for a series. We will have probably a discussion series. This doesn't warrant just one episode. That would be silly. So this is the first of many, more than likely. And if you like what you hear, don't forget to like, comment, subscribe, and share.
Mm-hmm.
And then Terrence will tell us to follow us on socials.
Yes, guys. So check us out at eigenbros.com, the main website. Check us out on Twitter, eigenbros. And then we have eigenbros on Instagram. And then also eigenbros2 on TikTok. Mm-hmm. And we will see you guys there.
2, 1.
Yeah.
We're live.
What's up, people?
Today, we are talking about string theory, aka bling theory. our theory of everything. Today we actually are talking about string theory, and it's a topic that we've needed to discuss.
Mm-hmm. Controversially.
because we've alluded to it multiple times, and it's just one of these topics in physics that never leave the
background of discussion. Or,
yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's one of these relevant things that people, you know, we've made many jokes about string theory, shit on it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, experimentalists love to shit on string theorists mm-hmm. because they're basically glorified mathematicians, we'll say.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, you know, I got to say I respect string theory a little more after researching it.
Yeah, so where does it all begin? Where does string theory?
So back in the 1970s, a time where people were wearing
hippie attire.
Yeah, hippie attire with their bell bottom jeans and
their boot flared leather cut boots, whatever. Yeah. Hey, what a good time for music, but
true.
But was it did the hippie sort of LSD acid kind of generation take affect physics in this way?
I think it might have. It had to have, because this
the vibration
theory is trippy
stuff?
As hell.
Yeah.
And yeah, so basically string theory is, it all began in around the 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
So a guy named, I think, Venanziano, I believe I'm saying his name correctly, came up with some theory that basically spawned the birth of string theory. It wasn't string theory that he came up with, but people took a hold of it, and string theory kind of fell out, or that idea came to be mm-hmm. because of his theory. Basically what string theory is essentially just kind of what it sounds like. It's vibrating strings. So typically physicists, we like to use points, you know, lines, circles, that kind of thing, those easy geometric shapes. We even mentioned that in the last podcast, how I try to make everything into a point and a line or a circle.
Yeah.
But with string theory, it's basically saying that the fundamental, constituents of matter, so like quarks and leptons and bosons, they're all made of strings. So tiny little vibrating strings. So if you imagine a typical like electron, as you see in the textbook, the little blue sphere, instead of just being a blue sphere, that blue sphere is now actually being created because it's actually a vibrating string. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, I joke often that if physicists went with string theory because they were they didn't want to be memed into obscurity by calling it spring theory, because everything is according to physics, everything is a harmonic oscillator.
Yeah, it's kind of an inside joke of physicists, like, yeah. You're just doing, what is it, like an expert in physics is just someone who can extrapolate higher and higher orders of harmonic oscillators. Yeah. So no spring theory. They switched it up a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, and funny enough, I think one of the first toy model examples is a spring in quantum mechanics, how you can get string theory by approximating this string, but it's really it shows that the harmonic oscillator with quantized energies comes out from approximating it. It's an interesting little, I forget which book I read it from, but it's one of these textbooks that they use for teaching undergraduates quantum mechanics. I think it's towards the end where they're like, hey guys, look at this cool thing.
They try to suck you into becoming a string theorist. Sorry guys, we'll lay off the
but
string
it's,
theory.
But it's interesting. It's interesting. So it came out of the 70s, and I'm sure around that time you had a lot of very talented geniuses, right? You had a lot of brains coming at this theory. Do you happen to know what kind of, I guess, what was the one catalyst, you would say, that on your research of it, like
that made string theory kind of blossom?
Yeah.
Well, let me think. So I think the big thing that kind of really started selling people on string theory was the whole graviton. Mm-hmm. So for those of you who are not familiar, we have a standard model of particle physics, and it's composed of things like quarks, leptons, and bosons. I guess neutrinos are leptons as well, and those are basically the particles that compose like protons and neutrons, mm-hmm. electrons, all those things. And one of these hypothetical particles called the graviton, it's a spin 2 particle, a bosonic particle, actually kind of fell out from string theory. With the right terms, you know, if you have the right energies and these certain parameters, they came to find that this theory was actually producing gravity naturally. So something that looked like gravity, at least naturally. And that was a huge win compared to any other real theory, because all the previous theories, you know, it's kind of, you kind of get stuck where gravity is this separate thing, and you have electromagnetic force, the weak force and the strong force tie up really nicely together. And I think that's covered in things like Yang-Mills theory. Mm-hmm. But the gravity somehow doesn't ever fit in. So when, I forget who it was that discovered this, but when gravity fell out of string theory, that's when people started really flocking towards it. Mm-hmm. And they realized, oh, this could be the one.
Yeah.
Because it literally is necessary. It's a consequence of the theory. And usually when things are just falling out of theories and they're matching to other parts of well-established knowledge, that's when people are going to start taking things more seriously. Mm-hmm. It kind of reminded me of the whole Dirac equation. Like Dirac's equation became convincing because he was trying to basically find a relativistic equation for quantum mechanics or for quantum particles, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But his theory actually, spin actually fell out of that.
Yeah.
So you needed to have spin in order to make it work. Mm-hmm. So you started to get these things for free that were explained by the theory. Whereas beforehand, you had to actually like ham fist these things. Like if you wanted spin in quantum mechanics, you had to just throw in a spin term, right? But with Dirac's equation, it actually fell out of the theory. So that's it's a very similar thing that happened with string theory.
It's deeper and richer, explains a lot more fundamentally from, as opposed to shoehorning things in.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So string theory is pretty interesting. And over time, it got more and more developed. Of course, you know, there's some big names involved with this. One of them being Edward Witten, String Daddy, as we call him. he's a beast, and basically he was the guy that unified a bunch of string theories. And this was about in 1995, so they were going at it for quite a while. there's some other guys that are famously involved with string theory that I didn't know about. Nima Arkani Hamed.
Uh-huh.
He's famous from string theory.
So is Penrose.
Oh, really?
Twisters, right?
I don't know if that has to do with string theory.
I think it does.
Does it? Okay.
I'm going to say, well, super strings, I know that.
But. Okay. That's out of what I studied, so yeah, I don't really know. There's another guy whose name is slipping my mind. It starts with an H. Anyway, if I can remember it, I'll bring it up again.
He'll post it as a brief image on the podcast. But yeah, so there's a group of these people working at this. This theory is, from what I know, purely a theoretical, how would you say,
model
exercise.
Okay,
right.
Continue on. Maybe you're right.
This seems like it's. There's a proposition that maybe we can approximate the universe as strings as opposed to point particles, and then you kind of evolve the theory in a more fundamental way. You test Schrödinger's equations, and you kind of. I think there was a video you sent me to look at that was that said that the correction for electromagnetism was included in for gauges allowed gauge. Mm-hmm. Variance, but that there was a proposition that Schrödinger's equation should remain gauge invariant, meaning that if you change it, depending on the scenarios, it should look the same, or the energies we get, we should look the same.
Mm-hmm.
But out of this came out a more fundamental approach, which was like, oh, now you're coupling quantum and E&M in a meaningful way, and then you little by little get other interesting results like gravitons coming out and stuff like that.
Well, one of the interesting things about string theory that also makes it powerful is it is a gauge invariant. So string theory is like kind of a combination of two types of math in some ways. It's a conformal field theory as well as a gauge theory. And basically that just means that it's a quantum field theory. So conformal field theory has to do with quantum field theory.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say if you guys are, you know, trying to be up and coming physicists and you want to work on leading edge, you know, theory of everything type stuff, you'll probably want to become a field theorist or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because the real, I guess, discrepancy right now with combining all of the different regimes of physics is the fact that we're trying to get a theory that is consistent with quantum physics and general relativity, right?
Yeah,
that's
yeah, yeah.
where the gap kind of lies. But anyway, string theory is a conformal field theory with a gauge theory. So the gauge theory basically tells you all the symmetries that are involved with the differential equations that are involved with that particular string theory. So when I say that particular string theory, there's actually five different types. So there's a type one string theory, which has to do with these things called closed and open loops. So mm-hmm. if you think of the string, right,
mm-hmm.
you can think of it as like a little loop. So like the string is now connected back from on its vertices. And that has to do with closed and open loops. You can also have an open loop where it's just like an actual line where there's two actual points
mm-hmm.
at each end. And that's type one string theory. It's a supersymmetric theory, which I can get into a little bit later. Then there's also type 2A and type 2B string theory, which is a super string theory as well. But these ones have to do with closed loops. So one of the so these only have closed loops.
Mm-hmm.
So they can't have any open loops as in type 1. But the closed loops in type 1 and type 2A they have no chirality.
Mm-hmm.
And then in type 2B there is a chiral nature to those two loops.
And chirality has to do with like intrinsic spin stuff, right?
I believe so. Yeah, I don't know for sure. I won't say that for sure because I didn't know. I didn't research enough to see exactly what the chirality meant in this case.
Yeah.
But it means handedness if you want to think generally, right?
Yeah,
like we have a right hand and a left hand.
Yeah.
So a right hand doesn't look the same, you know, in certain systems. Like handedness matters.
Yes.
So that's the type A and the type B for that's type 2A and type 2B for super mm-hmm. string theory. And then there's the final last two super string theories, which are the heterotic string theories. And those have to do with a mixture of bosonic string theory with super string theory. So bosonic string theory is not even really considered a string theory because it's not consistent. but it's a way to derive string theory in a very simple way because you're only dealing with bosons.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, in real life, we have fermions, right? So that's where the superstring, the supersymmetry comes in.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why type 1, type 2A, and type 2B, and then the heterotic string theories, HO and HE, they all use supersymmetry because you have fermions in real life as well. So then the heterotic string theories also use closed loops, but they're the difference is they have this weird hybrid between bosonic string theory and supersymmetry.
Mm-hmm.
So all those string theories, you're just like, that's a lot of goddamn string theories.
Yeah.
So there's five major super string theories, and mm-hmm. supersymmetry is kind of the way to go in terms of string theory. But then you're like, that's too many theories, right? We need one.
Yeah.
So then that's where Big Daddy String Daddy came in, Ed Witten.
Yeah.
He ties them all up. So he basically came up with M theory that created this 11-dimensional theory that encompassed all of them. So all of those things he could show that they went to the 11-dimensional M theory in certain limits, and then they all became this weird unified M theory. Which is why another reason why people got excited. So he caused the second string revolution, as they say.
GUT.
Yeah,
Grand
yeah.
Unified theory.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. The gut. Yeah. There's a gut feeling that physicists have. This has to be true.
Yeah, but it was pretty crazy. It was a wild thing to basically unite all of those string theories. And that's why also Ed Witten has the reputation as like one of the smartest guys to ever live.
Yeah.
Even if string theory is not right, I mean, it's just a feat to be able to
brilliance
tie all those together.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is. Living legend, Edward Witten. Mm-hmm. Who is on Twitter?
He is.
Surprisingly. Okay.
For some reason, he is.
Discovered by the Eigen Bros. I don't think anybody else knew.
Yeah, at least his follower count went up a lot as I put it out there that he was on Twitter. Yeah. I'm just going to say. I'm not going to take full credit, but I'm just saying.
Yeah.
But he only tweets about politics and anti-Trump.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to see. I mean, he lives in New Jersey. I think he studies at the Princeton, the Advanced Studies Institute, I believe.
I'm not sure.
It's where it's where the guys that just get paid to do research.
Mm-hmm.
The highest levels of
Big boys.
Of intellect, yeah.
And big boys and gals.
Big bills and gals, yeah. It's pretty split evenly, I think.
Almost. Oh, really?
I think so.
In gender, you mean?
I think in gender.
Oh, okay, nice.
I was like, wow, this is, it's impressive that we're able to kind of keep an even disparity, because like there's a lot of women physicists that are slept on, I imagine, in a male-dominant field.
Yeah.
But,
sure.
Emmy
Noether.
Yeah, I mean,
classic example.
Classic example.
That's a while ago, though.
But. That is. But she's also a legend in her own respect. Ed Witten, M theory, and then we get Grand Unified Theory, and that GUT is probably what, almost 15 years old? No, 25 years old.
Which one? The M theory?
GUT.
Well, GUT just means Grand Unified Theory, right?
But
because the thing is, if you have Grand Unified Theory, then it's complete, right? The definition of Grand Unified Theory basically means that it's a complete theory of everything.
Oh, so his M theory doesn't...
No, doesn't it just unifies all the string theories.
Oh, gotcha.
And I think the string theories are considered... don't quote me on this because it's actually... I'm not entirely sure.
More
this,
research
but I think
is needed.
Yeah, but I think it's considered an effective field theory.
Okay.
So effective mean it only works within certain energy regimes.
Gotcha.
But ideally, you want a theory that works in all regimes. And I think this is because of renormalization problems. So this is another key word that some of you may be familiar who are physicists and others who are laymen won't know, but it's kind of a big concept in physics. So renormalization has to do with, it's basically like a shorthand where you're, as Feynman called it, like sweeping under the rug these infinities.
Yes.
So it's kind of a bullshit thing to do. It's a very mathematical trickery type thing to do, but it works, and experimentally has been confirmed in some ways.
This is what separates mathematicians from physicists.
Yeah.
Really. It really does.
We have the beautiful thing of being able to check in real life. So we're just like, if it works, then, you know.
It explains it somehow. So
like, I'm satisfied as long as it works.
Yeah.
So what they do basically is, if you guys are familiar with Feynman diagrams, in Feynman diagrams, you have these certain areas where you have these energy terms that actually blow up to infinity.
Yes.
And what you have to do is you have to put this kind of fudge factor renormalization thing in here where you're getting rid of these infinities so that your theory will be more tame and you can actually still do the calculations properly. Long story short, I'm not going to get much into it because also I don't know enough about renormalization to talk too confidently on it.
Yeah, it's a mathematical process. I think a lot of theories fail the renormalization test. I think, for instance, the Bohmian mechanics interpretation, I think it fails renormalization.
Okay, so that's the Bohmian mechanics has to do with quantum mechanics. It's an interpretation of quantum mechanics.
Yeah, the pilot wave theory, quote unquote.
Right.
I think it fails to be renormalized.
Okay.
There are quite a number of theories that don't pass that test, which is interesting. There are some theories that did pass. I think the first test is like invariance. You're seeing if things are invariant under certain transformations.
Right. And this can be related to gauge theory.
Right.
Like if you have gauge invariance, it means that your system doesn't care, your Lagrangian doesn't care what coordinate system you're in.
Right.
It's just like if you put it in spherical coordinates, you put it in whatever coordinates, it's always going to have this certain symmetry to it.
Yeah. The answers or the energies are going to come out the same.
Yeah.
Yeah. Probably up to certain, there's certain, like you get introduced to gauges. If you want to study this in a more, I guess, how would you say, rudimentary level, you can look at Griffiths, ENM. I think he tackles...
a couple gauges.
Yeah.
That's the first time I've ever been introduced to it.
Same. Yeah. But,
I think, and that's the only time I've ever been introduced
to it.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, same here.
That's what I was like, oh, this is kind of powerful, you know?
It is, but you can play with these like ENM models of gauges and stuff, and you get to see what it means for something to be gauge invariant. And he gives you like a gauge potential, and you just play with the math, and you're like, oh, I guess it didn't really change the answer.
Yeah, and it's actually a way to to decouple the electric field and the magnetic field. For those of you who are studying E&M, you know, if you're like an undergraduate, there's some cool stuff you can learn from that because you can see, oh, I can actually, you see in Maxwell's equations, you see the E and the B's are all coupled together, but with gauge theory, you can actually decouple them.
Yes.
In an interesting way.
It's very cool. That's if renormalization, well, renormalization is still, we don't deal with that until you get to basically graduate school level,
like quantum field theory and things.
QFT, I took quantum many body, stuff like that, where you're actually dealing with Feynman diagrams or the introduction of Feynman diagrams.
Oh, so you know about renormalization.
I do, yeah,
okay,
yeah.
Maybe you could put some more insight there because I don't know anything.
That's pretty much what it is.
Okay.
Yeah.
So for the audience, I have not taken quantum many body systems or QFT, which they're both pretty related.
Yeah.
So for me, this is all just kind of just new research that I've done. And it's not that in-depth for a podcast. So.
Right. But no, I mean, in function, it's exactly what you're saying. It's this. It's the act of mathematically sort of sweeping under the rug, like you're saying, or hand-waving away infinities.
In a mathematically allowable way.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Through the use of Feynman diagrams, this is what makes Feynman diagrams so useful. And Feynman diagrams are like these interesting logical set of rules, diagrammatic logical set of rules that...
It's literally pictures of lines and squiggly lines and stuff. It's kind of cool.
I want to say that he actually invented them. I know Feynman experimented with psychedelics. I know that because I read his autobiography or his book.
I don't even have to read it. I just know.
So I know that he did. He played around with psychedelics. So I wonder if this was motivated by that because there's a lot. I mean, this theory was born from the 70s. And I know that at the time, people that were experimenting with psychedelics and hallucinogens, powerful hallucinogens, they people get this sense that they have the universe is like, I have friends, I've never taken psychedelics, but I have friends that when they take it, they say, oh, I have one friend in particular who's never studied physics. And he's like, dude, I felt like the universe was just vibrations. Like he could see, he says he could see the vibrations and stuff. And
it
I was like,
very Bill Hicksian.
Sure. Yeah. But he's like, I felt everything like all, it felt like waves, man. And I was just like, interesting. It's almost like these people that are not, don't know anything about physics. They're like peeling back this like processing layer that the brain does where it, you know, our brains are Fourier analysis. They take in frequencies and then generate them into meaningful images and stuff, it's almost like you're peeling back that layer. And I wonder if a lot of these physicists were like, it's interesting to think, let's think about the universe as made of fundamentally vibrating, like oscillating part.
And you're saying due to psychedelics.
I wonder.
I wouldn't be shocked. Not that I'm going to say that was the only way to come up with it, but I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah. If here's a quick question. If I've never seen a good string theory documentary, but if you folks that are listening right now, if you do know of any good ones, like drop it down below, we'll pin it. Because I do want to see a complete history if it's possible that there's a...
There's several on YouTube I've noticed, but I didn't actually... The only one I looked at was this it's not a documentary, but I looked at an interview with Ed Witten it was in the year 2000.
Yeah.
So it's 5 years after he did the M theory unification. Yeah. And he basically does a really nice layman, as layman as you can possibly do. He did a very good job at trying to make it as layman friendly as possible of what string theory is and some of the motivations and why it's so powerful. Mm-hmm. It's a great interview. I would definitely check that out. It probably comes up first when you just type in Ed Witten string theory.
Yeah. If not, we'll post it in the comment box below.
Yeah.
So that timeline it's a very quick timeline, you're saying, from what you saw. It's the 70s, and then we get to 20 years of work or so, and then we get to M-Theory, the modern version.
Yeah, they go ham on it, basically. Yeah. So then they just start cranking it out, basically, and coming up with shit like, oh, for the graviton to exist, we need 10 dimensions now, or 10 dimensions plus time, so 11 dimensions total. And then they start doing things like, oh, well... For fermions to exist, we need supersymmetry. Mm-hmm. And then it just gets more and more untenable. So string theory is cool, but the problem now arises from, okay, why do experimentalists talk shit about string theory? Because now you're starting to add things that are more and more higher levels of abstraction and theory based on no evidence. It's all based on making the mathematics and the theory work. So this is where you can get into a little trouble with physics. So... You have to start making testable things, right? So, okay. So string theory claims 10 dimensions, all right? So then you say, well, we live in a society that's obviously 3 dimensions plus time, if you want to include that. It's kind of like it's not a spatial dimension, so it's a time dimension. Mm-hmm. But you can say, okay, we live in a 4-dimensional space-time, right? But then where are the other, remaining 7 dimensions, right? I only see 4. Where's the 11 that we need? So what they do?
It's a liberal hoax, Terrence.
QAnon.
Fake news.
Right.
Yeah.
But so yeah, that begs the question, right? Mm-hmm. So then, what physicists do is they say they're curled up dimensions. So now I'm kind of like, well, what the fuck is this? Curled up dimensions? What do they even mean?
Yeah.
But now it's grown on me. I'm kind of like, okay, I get it. It's kind of there's some legitimacy to this, I believe. So. Or at least it sounds like a good remedy. So what that means is the dimensions are so small that basically it's irrelevant to us within our length scales, right? So this is where the Planck length and things like this and Planck time and Planck mass start to come in. So I'm sure some people are probably familiar with that. Planck time and Planck length. I even did a tweet on Planck length. It's like showing the limits or the edges of what our physics are. So basically Planck length, for example, is a quantity that was invented purely on dimensional analysis. So some people might think it's some motivated quantity that's quantizing space. The Planck length is the smallest distance. I had this misconception even when I was beginning undergraduate. I was like, oh, the Planck length is this fundamental smallest length. And I was like, oh, that's so cool. I wonder how they got that. But literally, it's not anything that deep. It's literally just dimensional analysis using these kind of sacred constants that we know of.
Mm-hmm.
The speed of light, C. Universal gravitational constant, mm-hmm. G, big G. And then Planck's constant.
Mm-hmm.
So these constants show up constantly. These constants show up a lot in physics. Mm-hmm. So then it begs the question that, are these like these really weird fundamental constants? So Planck rearranged these constants in such a way to give you the right dimensions of length. And that's where the Planck length comes in. And the same for Planck time and Planck mass. But anyway, that's relevant because in these curled up dimensions, they're so small that they're within the regimes around those like Planck scale or Planck lengths.
Right.
So we can't actually interact with them. Mm-hmm. It's too small for us to see. And the dimensions are curled up because all six or seven of those dimensions, I guess, are all curled up so small that humans have no interaction with them. And an example that people give you of what that could look like is a curled up dimension. For instance, if we see that in our macro scale, imagine if you see a fishing line. So let's say you have a fishing line in front of you and an ant is walking on that fishing line. To us, that just looks like the ant is in one dimension, right? He's only going on one dimensional line, either forward or back on the line. But let's say if you switch your reference frame to the ant can literally see himself on two dimensions because now he can go around that. So he has an angular component to his dimensions. Mm-hmm. So you can say that to the perspective of humans, our length scale is too big to see that second dimension. So literally that's a curled up dimension. That extra dimension of angle, being able to go around the fishing line, is a curled up dimension.
Gotcha.
So that's the kind of thing that happens as well in string theory.
Gotcha.
When you're considering these extra dimensions of space, mm-hmm. space time.
It's compacted in this, like, in what, depending on the reference. Well, it takes a certain stroke of genius to see that.
Yeah.
That, yeah, there are more dimensions compacted into this seemingly trivial dimensionality.
Right? Yes. Yeah. And these are mathematically called these Calabi-Yau manifolds. So mm-hmm. you might be familiar with that as well. There's these real trippy looking like manifold.
I've seen the pictures.
Yeah, I'm sure you've probably seen them. They're these real trippy looking, like, they look like crinkled up sheets of like paper. And manifolds are just basically fancy words of saying like surfaces. So it's this really weird crinkled up, you know, surface. And those are the things that exist at those super small like Planck scales. But the problem is now with string theory is they're trying to figure out, one of the things is which Calabi-Yau manifold actually is the one that exists within string theory. And unfortunately, they can come up with so many. There's like on the order of like 10 to the 500
wow.
possible ones. So this is a problem of string theory where we're running into again of now the theory is becoming untenable. There's a lack of testability because mm-hmm. you can't just see what Calabi-Yau manifold it is because there's so many, and then somehow come up with an experimental,
constraints.
Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly. Mm-hmm. So string theory has some testability problems. Now the other one has to do with supersymmetry. So supersymmetry is one of these things I'm sure you're familiar with it. One, I'm sure a lot of the audience is as well because of the LHC. So the LHC is a Large Hadron Collider that was looking for the Higgs boson, right? One of the other things, the other projects that they considered it for was for supersymmetric particles. So they were hoping that they would find these supersymmetric particles from string theory as just an extra, you know, extra icing on the cake after they've already found the Higgs. So they, mm-hmm. you know, popped the champagne bottles and all that once they found the Higgs, and now like, all right, the project's paid for itself. Now we can find supersymmetric particles.
Yeah.
But lo and behold, nothing has been discovered. No supersymmetric particles have been discovered. So that is another problem experimentally. So the nice thing about that for string theorists is, though, the energy scales are not so constrained to just the energy scales of what the LHC operates in. Mm-hmm. So we can have the supersymmetric particles exist in higher energy scales.
Right.
But that's another problem, right? Because we want more constraints experimentally mm-hmm. or else we're just like, what is this theory? It's literally a theory of everything because it can just be anything. You know, it can be everything.
Yeah.
So the problem there is now we need constraints within what can the supersymmetric particles, what energies do they exist in?
Mm-hmm.
And you need those. And basically, I guess I should describe a little bit more what supersymmetric particles are.
Yes, please.
So basically, supersymmetric particles, they're there as a way to get rid of some of those infinities within the theory.
Okay.
And that means that every particle that we know of in the standard model also has a supersymmetric particle.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're a boson, you have a supersymmetric fermion. And if you're a fermion, you have a supersymmetric boson. So that's where they get those weird names, like you've probably seen them, like protons. So it'd be quarks. So like if you have a quark, they call them squarks. for the supersymmetric quark. Mm-hmm. And then you can get even more fined up where you can say like a down quark is a down or something. I don't know. And then they also have the leptons are fermions as well. So they'll have sleptons. And then the bosons, they'll add eno to the ends. So if you have like a photon, the supersymmetric version of a photon is a photino. So they're looking for all these supersymmetric partners, but that just means that now you've literally just doubled the standard model. So you should be seeing some of these particles in nature. And so far we've seen zero, so that's a problem.
Yeah. Interesting. Did you read on how like they would detect them? Are they supposed to be attainable using, are they in the resolution of the LHC that has
that? That's the thing, is the theory is so non-constrained energy wise. The resolution it may not be within the resolution of the LHC. Mm-hmm. It could be in higher orders of energy, right? So they're hoping that, you know, I think the LHC is powered down right now. You might have to check me on that one. Do you know?
Well, I saw one of our buddies that does work over at LHC.
Yeah.
Shout out to Red One.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he's over there. And he's looks like he's taking a vacation, so I don't think it's on.
Yeah, I think they're powered down. Yeah. So with that, I think they should be increasing their energy scales. Mm-hmm. So for the supersymmetry people out there, the string theorists, I guess they will be hoping that the LHC with its new energies, if it is being upgraded, mm-hmm. will be able to find the resolution necessary to be able to find some of these supersymmetric particles.
Right.
So the nice thing about LHC collisions and proton collision did they collide gold or protons? I forget now.
I don't know.
Whatever. So they collide some particle. With these collisions, as long as the energies are high enough, you're going to get any possible particles to come out there. Because all particles exist within whatever the energies that you collide.
I mean, you're getting the fundamental, like the electrons, you're getting
Yeah, like neutrons, particles can pop in and out of existence. Protons. Like this has been shown experimentally as well as theoretically. Any particles should be able to exist as long as the energy scale is as long as it's within the energy scale, right?
From the ether.
Yeah. Well.
Tongue-in-cheek.
From the vacuum, I guess you could
say.
Yeah,
no, it's from the vacuum,
like
yeah. It's vacuum energy, which is cool. That's one thing that I did when I was taking this quantum antibody course, the vacuum energy stuff was super interesting because I was like, wow. Because, I mean, fundamentally, yes, there is a vacuum energy in a sense that, you know, the cosmic microwave background radiation is sort of...
It's like a minimal energy.
In the universe. Yeah. So, but it's just interesting that, that you have particles pop up to try to conserve some sense of, how would you say?
Well, it's energy conservation, basically, right? I mean, this is like what people say when they're like...
fundamental principles of the...
E equals MC squared.
Yeah.
Because it's like, if your energy is enough, if you're literally creating these explosions that are such high energy, the conversion from energy to mass, it's the mass and energy can be converted back and forth. Mm-hmm. So as long as the energy is not lost, it's not being lost, it just can be converted into a mass. So you can literally create particles out of just pure energy, cool. Which sounds like some fanciful fucking hippie shit, but it actually is real.
Magic. Yeah.
So those are two of the big parts of, the problem / unknown areas of string theory, supersymmetry, and then those higher dimensions, right?
Well, since we're on the topic, I want to just kind of briefly talk a little bit about the problem stuff. What I've read so far, it seems to me that the experimental constraints, one workaround that a lot of string theorists are trying to find is they're trying to relate theory that's already been established within string theory, of course, to already validated experimental data, right? Mm-hmm. So they're trying to find ways to connect their abstract theory into the observable stuff.
Yeah.
Right? Of course, that's like a lot of homework for a lot of these guys. Because you have to find ways to validate logically how you could test these things or connected to already established theories in a very undeniably how would you say?
It's an undeniable way.
Yeah, undeniable way. There's no other way to put it. Yeah.
I think the hard thing about that is that with string theory, it's already shown that it reproduces like things like quantum mechanics and stuff. Right. That's one of the allures of it, right? And it aligns well with like GR, general relativity, and it reproduces a lot of stuff that already exists. But the problem is we already know those exist, right? Mm-hmm. So really the test is, can we confirm anything that's new that string theory predicts?
Right.
And that has to do with things like the 11 dimensions, the supersymmetry. So mm-hmm. you need to have things that are like brand new from string theory that are getting predicted. There's some other things with axions that I really wish I got a chance to research more. And I don't know anything about them, but I know we have some friends, someone we know, I think. Oh, actually, I think Irene has done some things with axions.
Cool.
Irene is from the Beyond the Physics podcast. Mm-hmm. And Irene, if you're watching, confirm that for me. I don't know if that's true or not, but I think I remember you mentioning that. But axions are these particles that I think came from string theory predictions. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we need some things that string theory uniquely predicts that can be confirmed.
Yeah.
Which nothing has yet. So it really is in dire need of some experimental help, big time.
Yeah. This will more than likely be, we were discussing it, this will probably more than likely be a discussion series on string theory because, like you're saying, there's so many subtypes of theories.
Unformally, a discussion series because we're not going to say like it's part one of two.
Right.
We're going to, as we come to it, I'm sure we'll talk about it again.
For sure. But no, I want to bring somebody who's like actually studied this stuff. Maybe talk to.
Well, the thing is, nobody at our school does string theory.
No, I know, but there are people in the math department that study these like manifolds, and it's kind of it's more mathematical physics in that lens.
But we got field theorists, though.
We do.
That are actually pretty adjacent to string theory.
Very true. The thing is, like, a lot of these, if you're doing physics and you want to study this high-level theory stuff, you will more than likely be pushed out into mathematical physics. Meaning,
but that's where all the big stuff is, right?
Meaning you'll be pushed into the math department.
Yeah. The more math, high-order stuff, like if you know group theory and you know, like, topology, gauge theory, all these things are going to become relevant to you if you're studying, if you're on the bleeding edge of like trying to figure out grand unified theories and things like that. You definitely want to go down that trail if that's the case.
Like our good friend Jesse, friend of the show, who studies at Penn State, he's in that camp.
Mm-hmm.
He studies these higher level stuff that is mostly pushed into the math department.
Yeah.
Like he can't study this at the physics department.
Right. You're climbing up the ivory tower.
Yeah.
The mathematicians are like, come join us.
Yeah, exactly. And it's kind of interesting how you see this divergence because I do see a lot of academics that functionally know this level of physics.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot, there's quite a number of physicists in our department that know.
Yeah, like the field theorists in our department would definitely be able to cross into this regime, I'm sure of it.
Yeah. And the thing is, but largely it's just kind of interesting that they still teach that. I mean, I don't know. Do you think, I guess they still need to teach field theories because
field theory is actually has experimental
confirmation
things. Like, of course, one of the big ones is the alpha, the fine structure constant.
Course, yeah.
I mean, it's got like 13 decimals of precision. It's insane.
Yeah. Yeah.
So quantum field theory is pretty damn solid, even despite the renormalization stuff. You know, a lot of physicists famously didn't like it too much, like Dirac specifically. But it's
just because it wasn't beautiful enough.
Right. Dirac's and his beauty. But I'm like, Dirac, bro, you come up with some crazy wild idea.
Yeah.
But no, respect to Dirac. He's the mensch, the ubermensch.
He is.
But you know, truly the quantum field theory is a experimentally confirmed theory, very well experimentally confirmed theory, so it's gonna stay. And that's why it's taught everywhere and you know, nationally. Or actually internationally as well.
Mm-hmm.
So string theory is just not complete yet. And people are thinking it's not going to be complete because it's still just stagnant now to this day.
Yeah, I heard, well, in this particular book here that I was kind of scanning a little bit before the podcast, this one's called Super Strings and the Search for the Theory of Everything by David Peat, and a P-E-A-T. He talks about how we've reached this era of postmodern physics. So modern physics was, you know, in the 70s.
It's old news.
Yeah. But now we're postmodern physics where we're in this regime of abstraction where experimentalists can't catch up. We don't have the mechanical prowess yet or the to really validate a lot of these high level theories. And I mean, you kind of had that early on, you know, I guess what was it? In the 1920s where you had some theorists make certain predictions that weren't validated until 50 years later or so.
Yeah.
Yeah. This seems
well, Higgs is a good example of that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
He literally just got, you know, the Nobel Prize from the discovery. You know, was it back in like 2012 or something?
Yeah, 2012. Yeah. Okay. About a decade ago.
Yeah, but he made that prediction so long ago.
Yeah.
So.
And that's how it's going to be. It's going to be like that for a good while until our engineering catches up or maybe our funding gets better for scientific endeavors. So.
Yeah, but string theory, it's an interesting one, man. It's got some ways to go for sure. And I mean, they can't even complete it, I don't think, which is...
Why?
Because I think it's still an effective field theory. I'm not sure if it's actually completed. Actually, let me rescind that.
Until we get an actual string
theory. My information is not completely there yet for that. I don't know if string theory is completed theory or not.
Yeah, but this is sort of an introduction. Maybe we'll bring on some more people that can discuss string theory at a more, I guess, rigorous level, maybe even like the history. And
I don't know any string theorists.
I think I know somebody.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. I think I know one or two people that could discuss this ad nauseum if even.
Okay. Yeah, if you got somebody, by all means, because I don't. What's the time? What are we looking at?
45.
Okay, cool.
Solid 45, okay, cool. I think. But yeah, is there anything else that you want to add on? Anything new or interesting that you learned from your...
Well, I learned a shitload about this. You know, I didn't have this much of a knowledge of string theory because the last time I really looked at string theory was probably when I was, you know, a kid who was an undergraduate, you know, so I didn't have any concept of some of these higher level things. So I couldn't really give that good of a description. I used to know... Actually, this is even before I got into physics because I used to like watching just Michio Kaku and, you know, Neil deGrasse Tyson and all these guys talk about it. Brian Greene. I guess Neil doesn't really talk about it, but Brian Greene and Kaku. But
I remember asking a physicist when I was in my second college or something, my third college, one of those. I had a little rocky start in school. I remember asking one of the guys, and he's like, and I asked him, what's the problem with string theory? Why do people always talk about it? And he said, because there's a problem with the Lagrangian. It doesn't fit the Lagrangian model or something. So I don't know what he meant by that. And I still don't know what he meant by that. Cause even when I researched it, I didn't know what the problem with the Lagrangian is, but apparently, so I think the theory is not complete. I think there's some issue with the Lagrangian.
He's like, if it's better with the Ronskian or whatever.
Well, I think the Lagrangian is just not complete somehow. Because field theorists, all they do basically is they're finding Lagrange densities. I don't even know if he meant the Lagrange density. I assume so. So I think the Lagrangian is still not yet to be found. So Lagrangian, once you have that, that's everything, right?
Of course.
So I think it's just incomplete.
Gotcha.
Yeah, anything.
All right. Well, I guess, you know, I still have to finish this book, and we still have to add it, so I can add to this discussion a lot more, but we will for sure be talking.
Do you have any other questions?
Not really. I mean, I kind of knew, like, certain things because of the class, but we didn't really touch, obviously, you don't touch on string theory because it's not really a valid theory just yet.
Yeah.
So
we only touch on things once it's been experimentally confirmed at a pretty high level, and then we're pretty sure it's going to be right.
Yeah, but actually, I do want to give a shout out to PBS.
Space Time.
Yeah, they have a pretty decent series on the
normal size
theory.
Peter Dinklage guy, whatever his name is.
I forget. No disrespect, man, but like, he's actually he's great. He's check out the channel. They do talk about string theory, why it's appealing, and then why it's wrong.
Yeah, so, actually, that was a really good channel for me to get myself brushed up on. Because he literally said why one of his videos why string theory is right and then why string theory is wrong. And it was a nice, like, good 17 minute video. Mm-hmm. So it's very enlightening.
So yeah, go ahead and watch those. Shout out to them.
Yeah.
I guess that's it, right?
That's it.
Yeah.
Damn, this is gonna be a short podcast.
Yeah, it's 50 minutes. I think 10 minutes. I can't really add anything new.
Okay.
So unless
you
can.
Yeah, true. No, I mean, we don't need to stretch it out artificially anyway, so that's fine. True.
But yeah, I guess stick around for the outro. We'll have a question for you.
Excellent.
Mm-hmm. Hey.
Hey.
Thank you for making it this far. Into the Super String Theory, String Theory episode.
No, you're right. It's because Super String Theory is the main one. So.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. Yeah. Super String Theory. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for making it this far. We would like for you to comment. At least I would like for you to comment. If there are any good docs that you've seen on string theory for the folks.
Leave them below, guys. Leave them below.
And for those of you listening to audio only, go ahead and check out a YouTube page and subscribe.
Yes, yes, please. That will help us. And me and Juan are trying to roll out some more things in the future, hopefully. Yeah.
We also have a Patreon. If you don't know, is it set up on whatever amount they want to pay?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
But you can pay a dollar. Just pay a dollar. That's all we need.
Or 2 cents. 1 penny for Terrence, 1 penny for me.
Hopefully at least a dollar, guys. Yeah, come on.
For the cost of, what are those commercials for? To supporting,
for like those animals.
Well, no, supporting like a certain foundation of, yeah, or like poor children in third world countries. For the
feed
cost,
one Eigen bro.
Feed one Eigen bro for just the cost of a cup of coffee.
Yeah. You can feed a Eigen bro for a month.
Yeah, exactly. You can, legitimately. You should see how me and Terrence live.
Right. But yeah, guys, shout out for the Patreon subscriber that, yes, we have. Black Thoughts, thank you once again.
And are you?
I think it's just Black Thoughts now.
Oh, no. We lost one.
Yeah, but that's okay.
Yeah, yeah.
I think he paid. Actually, I think he maybe paid for the month. We still got to figure out this whole thing. So we'll give Aria and Krisha shout out still, too.
Yeah, yeah.
But thank you, guys. Thank you both. Mm-hmm. Yeah, guys, make sure you check out our Patreon as well. We're also going to look for forward to doing some things maybe with YouTube memberships as well. So stay tuned for that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, guys, make sure to like, share, subscribe, comment, mm-hmm, as always. And then check us out at EigenBros.com. EigenBros on Instagram. EigenBros on Twitter. Sorry, mm-hmm, brain fart. And then EigenBros2 on TikTok.
Yep.
See you guys later.